going to be very difficult to protect every mile of pipeline without just an immense army. And now it may come right down to that in time.
Some of the male recruiters actually sexually assaulted a female recruiter. And this is the same group, you know, it's just this ongoing problem.
This is exactly the kind of thing that the students don't need. This is a kiss of death. They don't need the support of President Bush.
George Bush, with all his Secret Service, marched back up to my friend and said, "Let me shake your hand," thus transferring the truth-revealing Muti to the White House, which is where it is now.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, June 23rd, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Hundreds and possibly thousands of Iraqi civilians have been killed or maimed by outdated, defective U.S. cluster weapons that lack a safety feature other countries have added. That's according to observers, news reports, and officials. U.S. cluster weapons fired during the war in March and April dispersed thousands of small grenades on battlefields and in civilian neighborhoods to destroy Iraqi troops and weapons systems. But some types of the grenades failed to explode on impact as much as 16% of the time. That's according to official military figures. Battlefield commanders have reported failure rates as high as 40%. Unexploded grenades remain potentially lethal for weeks and months after landing on the ground, where civilians can unwittingly pick them up or step on them. Many victims are children, such as Ali Mustafa, 4, whose eyes were blown out when a grenade he played with near his Baghdad home in April exploded in his face. The so-called dud rate for cluster grenades can be reduced to less than 1% by installing secondary fuses that blow up or neutralize grenades that fail to explode on impact, according to defense contractors. In early 2001, the Pentagon said it would achieve that goal, but not until 2005. In the meantime, the military continues to use a vast arsenal of cluster grenades that fail to meet the new standard. Former military officials and defense experts say the effort to improve the grenades was given low priority and little funding. Last week, as the U.S. prepared to ship the first oil since the invasion of Iraq in March, the second major oil fire in a month raged out of control. On Saturday, a Reuters correspondent said thick smoke filled the sky 12 hours after an explosion at the oil fields near the town of Hit. The first oil fire was attributed to a gas leak on the main export pipeline from the Kirkuk oil fields to Turkey. It is believed that the second explosion was caused by saboteurs. Michael Clare, professor of peace and world studies at Hampshire College in Western Massachusetts, spoke to Peace Watch today. We asked him how much damage was caused by these oil fires and how the fires impact the efforts to rebuild Iraq.
It's a combination of the fires, which are very destructive, and the sabotage, and the fact that the whole system, the whole infrastructure, is in terrible shape. A lot of it has deteriorated terribly. So you have this combination of sabotage and a crumbling infrastructure that's going to make it extremely difficult to get oil production rolling again.
Do you think these fires are a result of saboteurs?
It's very likely. I mean, people who are attacking American soldiers on a regular basis would probably also see some political advantage in attacking the pipelines, because it's the pipelines eventually that are going to produce the oil that's going to pay for the occupation of Iraq. So it makes sense to me that opponents of American occupation would also attack the oil fields.
Does it strike you as odd that the Americans are unable to protect these oil fields, which by many's determination was the reason they went into Iraq in the first place?
The thing is that these pipelines are stretched back and forth all across the country. I mean, Iraq is crisscrossed with pipelines. So even with a very strong intention to protect them, and I think that intention is very strong, it's going to be very difficult to protect every mile of pipeline without just an immense army. And now it may come right down to that in time, but it shouldn't be surprising given the magnitude of the oil infrastructure in Iraq.
It's been suggested that this oil was being exported to Israel. What can you tell us about that?
Well, there's been some talk of eventually building a pipeline from Iraq that would be Israel. I think that this is a plan that was discussed in the Reagan administration, and whether or not that will come to pass, I think, still remains to be seen. At this point, Iraq is selling oil to whoever they possibly can to collect the revenues that'll pay for the occupation and the reconstruction of the country.
Now, when you say Iraq, of course, Iraq is under the direction of Paul Bremer and company. Is there any way of determining whether these profits are actually going to go to the Iraqi people or whether companies like Halliburton and the other U.S. companies that are contracted to help rebuild Iraq will stand to profit in any way from this and from these incidents that occur?
Yes, well, you're right in asking that. I mean, the profits that come from the oil supplies will be divided between that amount that goes to the companies that market the oil and sell it and export it. They'll get their cut, and a certain percent will go to the central authorities, the authority created by the United States and Britain to manage Iraq. They'll have control over the other part of the profits. So, you know, it will, quote, go to the benefit of the Iraqi people, unquote, but at the decision of U.S. authorities, what they choose to spend the money on, and some of it will go to the American corporations. And, of course, as you indicated, some of it will go to Halliburton and other American corporations which have contracts not to export oil, but to rebuild the infrastructure. That's Halliburton's role in all of this.
So do they stand to profit, the U.S. companies that are there in the capacity somehow of helping to move the oil, do they stand to reap major profits from this?
They will, of course, benefit from this as they would from selling oil from any producer. In other words, the marketing companies, the distribution companies, are benefiting in the same way they would if they were to export from Saudi Arabia or Kuwait or any other country. They're in the business of buying and selling oil. So Iraq now is going to increase the available supply, and the big oil companies will want to get as much of that as they can to refine and to sell. That's different from discussions about breaking up. The Iraqi oil is produced by a state-owned firm, the Iraqi National Oil Company. There is talk by Paul Bremer and others in the administration of privatizing this large company and selling off pieces of it to international oil companies. That would be a very different story. There you would have American or British companies in Iraq controlling the oil fields. But right now, American companies are only involved in exporting oil that's produced by the state-owned company.
Any final thoughts on your part?
I think the main thing is that there's a lot yet to be decided. We're still very early in this stage. The big prize, the really big prize, is the undeveloped oil in Iraq. There are many geologists who believe that Iraq has as much as 200 billion barrels of oil that's untapped and unexplored. Now, to give you a sense of magnitude, the United States is believed to have, Alaska included, maybe 30 billion barrels of untapped oil. So we're talking about the largest pool of untapped oil in the world, maybe under the ground in Iraq, that's never been developed. And that's the big prize. And the question is whether the U.S. will turn over that undeveloped oil to American companies. That would be, you know, the ultimate prize of going to war.
Michael Clare, professor of peace and world studies at Hampshire College in Northampton, Massachusetts. With no weapons of mass destruction found in Iraq, talk of impeachment of the president for deceiving the nation over Iraq's alleged weapons stockpile is beginning for the first time to receive a spattering of coverage in the mainstream media. Activists led by former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark have created a website, www.votetoimpeach.org, where people can sign a petition and donate to a campaign to publish sign-on ads in major newspapers across the country. Listeners to Pacific Station WPFW here in the nation's capital called in this morning and expressed their thoughts on this topic.
Did the president deceive the American people, Congress, Senate, and the world about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction? Should he be impeached for doing so if it's found to be the case?
Deceived? No.
because deceived implies that there was ignorance as to what this administration was up to. And I really don't think even those Americans who supported Bush were ignorant to what actually was taking place. I think most of us knew what this country had planned because it was evident that this plan was in effect long ago. Lied to? Yes, we were definitely lied to. And I think lying in itself, as with Nixon, is an impeachable offense, and at least bring him up the way Clinton was brought up. Even if he gets out of it, I think he should be brought before the public and made to answer a lot of the situations that are coming up at this time.
I just can't believe that the rest of the American people don't feel this way. One of the core values in my life is honesty and integrity, and this president is going against every bit of that. I feel like there should be an independent commission that looks into this. You know, this country used to impeach liars, and I just feel very strongly about it, and I can't believe that the rest of the people aren't thinking this way.
I'm appalled at the fact that it's taken the action to take place, and now people start being concerned about why it happened. They should have prevented it if they listened to the words of someone who was one. I know, because I had enough time served in Uncle Sam's military uniform, enough to know the kinds of strategies and the kinds of things that they do to achieve their ultimate goals, and that is to establish military presence throughout the universe or this world that we live in, so they can dominate and dictate to the rest of the world. And that's not the way it's supposed to be. The Bible says, take dominion over the earth, over the land, not over the people.
I think this administration came in office with the purpose to deceive, really to promote their agenda, starting with the election on to 9/11, which I think, my view is, 9/11 is major key. All these questions asked about 9/11, which have been shoved under the rug, under the carpet, if they ever came out with the truth of that, all this other stuff is moot. It would never, never, weapons or war, nothing would ever happen. They would have, the covers would have been off this administration. You know, onto these weapons of mass destruction, which I think probably they've already planted, and more than likely will use the UN to legitimize what's happening here with these weapons.
It's obvious that he deceived it. I was at the hearing of Representative Kucinich when he very dramatically, before a panel, described that he was on a committee that was required to be informed of intelligence, and he said that there was none.
I think the answer to all of those questions you just raised is a resounding no. But as to whether or not we were deceived, I think there's one way to know whether or not this president is lying, and that is, look at his lips. If they move, he's lying. The man is just incapable of speaking the truth. In our worst nightmares, would we ever have conceived that they would have disenfranchised tens of thousands of voters of color in South Florida to engineer the stealing of elections in the United States of America 35 years after passage of the Voting Rights Act? I mean, why did they go after Trent Lott in Mississippi? Was it because of anything he did? No. It was for being too honest about the strategies of the Republican Party. It's a very sad comment on where politics are today and where we as a people decide to assume the posture of an ostrich.
Here's my opinion. I think history will prove that President Bush did the right thing going to war to house the dictator that was in office. This world has no place for dictators who put up their tent and cause havoc to their own people and the world at large. I don't think Saddam Hussein is a fool not to covertly hide weapons of mass destruction, just like he's hidden and perhaps all the other debaucheries that he has caused down through the years. I think the right thing Mr. Bush did was going to war.
Okay, I believe that we should be looking at the 66,000 votes that were thrown away in Florida. That it was proven that those votes were thrown away. And if they can recall the governor of California, we can recall the president of the United States.
callers to this morning's community comment program on Pacifica Station WPFW, hosted by Ron Pinchback here in the nation's capital, expressing thoughts on the failure of the U.S. to find Iraq's alleged weapons of mass destruction and the campaign to impeach George W. Bush.
He's a cowboy president, but he wears a black hat. In America, can't get away with that. On the eve of destruction again, and he's got the knack. He's the cowboy president, but he wears a black hat. He come into town with a chip on his shoulder. His cowboy boots made him feel tall. He said, by proclamation, now there's a new order, and I am the fiercest leader of all. He wore a pair of six shooters, a bowie knife and a rifle, and a derringer stashed in his boot. He said, y'all drop your weapons, I'm here to disarm you. Don't give me a reason to shoot. Everyone protested, they all turned against him, said, just who do you think you are? He said, many are good, but many are evil, and I am the Avatar. They all drew and fired, he yelled, Condoleezza, if you're with me, then blast them to hell. She came riding side saddle, shouting out orders, twirling two pistols remarkably well. When it was over, there's nothing left standing, nothing moving, nothing to say. They drove the prisoners east to the boats for their hanging from the gallows overlooking Guantanamo Bay.
The Cowboy President by Yikes McGee. Claiming intelligence of planned attacks against diplomatic missions in France, the French government last week made sweeping arrest of 156 members of the Iranian group, the People's Mujahideen. In response, supporters of the Mujahideen ECALC held protests in Paris, Bern, London, and even Houston. Farah Charmchi from Pacifica Station KPFT files this report on the protests. She spoke with Ahmed Sadri, a professor of sociology at Lake College in Chicago, Illinois. His work has recently focused on the intellectual history of Iran, and recently he has written several pieces for an online journal, The Iranian. It's about the prospects and obstacles to reform in Iran.
Thousands of Mujahideen members and supporters have lived as exiles from their native Iran ever since remaining in Iran became too dangerous for them. Originally supportive of Ayatollah Khomeini's regime that came to power in the 1980 revolution, the group quickly turned against the Islamic Republic when its members realized they would have no role in the new government. Highly organized and armed with guerrilla tactics, they began their assault against the Ayatollah's regime, only to find their members brutally oppressed, with scores of them being executed. Clearly, the new government was willing to use the full extent of its force to crush the opposition. At the same time, we've been watching made-for-TV footage of these protesters setting themselves ablaze. Another kind of protest has been going on inside Iran, student protests, in which estimated thousands have crammed the streets of central Tehran, demanding an end to autocratic government. George Bush has continued his early cheerleading career by making frequent statements in support of the students' demands for more freedom. At the same time, his administration continues to make allusions to not tolerating a nuclear program in Iran. This week, in fact, marked the first time Bush used line-in-the-sand language, prompting Middle East watchers to scoot closer to the edges of their chairs. Ahmed Sadri is a professor of sociology at Lake College in Chicago, Illinois. His work has recently focused on intellectual history of Iran, and he's also written several pieces for an online journal, The Iranian, about the prospects and obstacles to reform in Iran. I spoke with Dr. Sadri this week and asked him, first of all, what his impression of the popular protests had been.
The protests started 9 days ago, and originally they aimed at some pretty limited aims. The students were protesting the proposed privatization of the universities in Iran. But quickly, it turned into a much wider protest. And this pattern is familiar because we have seen this under the Shah. Usually, student protests would start over very limited issues. And quickly, because of the almost pressure cooker situation in Iran, because of the oppression, because of the way in which the reform movement has been treated by the right wing, very quickly it develops into much wider protests against the government. And this has been going on in one way or another for the last 9 days. And the government has been more restrained than before. And the precedent for this is 2 years ago, this protest basically in about 23 days are heading towards the commemoration of the roughing up of students a couple of years ago. So if the government doesn't come down very, very hard on the protests, and they don't seem to be willing to do that at this point and pay the price, I think they are going to go on until the day in which the students had wanted to commemorate the beginning of the right-wing backlash against the reformist government.
I asked Dr. Sadri next about what he thinks about the White House's encouragement of what it calls first steps toward democracy by the students, and how might such comments be received from the students' point of view?
President Bush's comments, or the comments of American right-wing neoconservatives, are very counterproductive. This is exactly the kind of thing that the students don't need. This is a kiss of death. They don't need the support of President Bush, this kind of empty gesture. And all it does, it kind of gives ammunition to the right wing to say these are nothing but, you know, provocations by President Bush. President Bush has no business going around putting gold stars on the foreheads of the students. The students already are doing a good job, and it's entirely directed at Iran's internal politics. It is the flowering of 25 years of resentment by Iranians against the theocratic government. It has nothing to do with support for the American cause. And I think Americans, the best thing that they can do, not in this occasion, but in a lot of other areas in Iran, is to just stay out of it. Without anything that Americans can do or have done, things are going pretty well for the outcome that is going to be a lot more favorable to the United States than the present regime.
Student protests are nothing new in Iran, though. 4 years ago, everyone was speculating that the protests might lead to another revolution. In the 2000 Iranian elections, reformers won an overwhelming victory in parliamentary elections. I asked Dr. Sadri in what way he sees the recent events as a continuation or a break with earlier popular opposition to the government.
The level of dissatisfaction in Iran has reached a kind of pitch never before seen. It used to be that people really were attracted to the internal politics of the Islamic Republic. A lot of people participated in the elections. Elections had very high rates of participation in the 70% to 80% range. In the last election, people basically stayed away from the polls. These are the elections for the city and council and village councils. The reformers had won with high participation landslide victories in the previous four elections. In this last election, the fifth election that the reformers thought they were going to win, people basically didn't participate, which resulted in a win by the right wing. But this was a Pyrrhic victory because representatives that went to the councils in Tehran, the right wing, are elected by about 5% of the population. So the right wing knows that the crackdown on the reformers is causing a kind of disaffection and legitimation crisis for the Islamic Republic that in the long run they cannot do anything about. The goons can't help it. The iron fist can't help it. The bayonet can't help it. They need to have legitimacy. So cracking down on the students would basically make things a lot worse. I think they are going to try to hold that off as long as they possibly can, because they can't afford to pay any more price in the currency of legitimacy. So they are being a lot more circumspect this time around, and I think they are going to tolerate it as long as they don't feel that these demonstrations are really going to threaten a total collapse.
Does the government see the current protests as benign then, or powerless? President Khatami, who once enjoyed overwhelming popularity and support of these same students and reformers, has now lost a great deal of his legitimacy among all of them. I ask Sadri whether the issue is one of who leads reform, or whether there are actually fundamental changes in what reform means.
Those who supported the reform are gravitating to a more radical form of reform. I call this radical reform. where the demands are a lot more stark and a lot more simple. The demands are for a serious secular system in Iran, a total separation of church and state, an unhyphenated democracy. And this is the ideology that is going to carry the day. And these are the demands of Iranian reformers, although it has no political shape as of now.
And does he think support of such radical reform is reflected in parliament or only in the streets?
There are echoes of this in the words of the few sincere and strident reformers in the parliament. All of them are women. Fatemeh Haqiqatjou, for instance. This is where I get the outlines of what I call the new phase of reform, the radical reform.
I then ask Professor Sadri to give us some background and analysis on the recent French crackdown on the Mujahideen Khalq. How did that organization begin, and what's the real ideology that, after 40 years, still attracts such a strong opposition to the Islamic Republic?
The Mujahideen Khalq, the English translation of that would be the People's Crusaders. This is an organization that was formed under the Shah, and it was one of the leftist organizations that with Islamic tendencies. Basically, the way it developed was by reverse engineering of the Govarist movements, the leftist movements that idolized Che Guevara. So they created an Islamic version of that and called this the Marxist organization was Hadayan-e Khalq, the Fedayeen of the people. The Mujahideen kind of said, well, Muslims can have that too. And so they formed this Islamic organization. And the techniques were urban guerrilla warfare, which these days is known as terrorism. And they assassinated quite a few pro-government people, including American officials in Iran. After the revolution, they expected to be handed a big slice of the cake. Of course, the clergy were not about to share any with the Mujahideen. So Mujahideen kind of started to grumble and gravitate to the opposition pole in Iran. And, of course, this quickly escalated into warfare, and the Mujahideen started to use the same techniques of assassination they used against the Shah and his backers against the Islamic government, and they were quite successful because the profile of the Mujahideen activists is very close to the profile of the revolutionaries, so they could very easily infiltrate the Islamic government, and they killed a lot of Islamic Republic's officials in one explosion only. They killed about 75 of the highest officials of the Islamic Republic.
But the Mujahideen have been living in France for 20 years. Why these attacks now? Are we to believe the French government's claim that they had intelligence of impending attacks? Or are there other motives France may have had for such a drastic and sudden move?
Now, all of a sudden, what happens in France is that France decides to crack down on them and arrest their leader, Maryam Rajavi, who is the wife of the co-leader, Masoud Rajavi. What this means, the speculation, I think, to some extent, I agree with this, is that this is a move by France not to woo Iran, but to stymie the United States and to keep them from using the Mujahideen and their terrorist organization from waging a war against Iran. And so I think this should be, to some extent at least, seen as a gambit by the French against the American administration. On the other hand, the French have gained a huge popularity in Iran, not only among the government, but among the ordinary people, because the ordinary people in Iran don't favor the Mujahideen because of their collaboration with Saddam Hussein that is considered in Iran as evil incarnate. So the French seem to argue that doing this would give the French some leverage insofar as the signing of the additional protocol for IAEA that would give more powers of inspection to IAEA in Iran.
Finally, I asked Dr. Sadri what was his reaction to the Bush administration's demands that Iran renounce any aspirations to a nuclear program. He said that, more than anything, it was the behavior of the U.S. itself that promotes proliferation of nuclear weapons, citing its double standard as particularly threatening to those without nukes.
It is likely that Iranians are pursuing atomic weapons, but to go about this by just threatening Iran with invasion or sounding tough, I don't think that's going to cut it. We need a much more comprehensive approach to the issue. Otherwise, even if Iran signs the additional protocols, Iran is going to continue to seek nuclear weapons. It is likely that Iran will continue. It is also likely that other countries would do the same.
You can read essays by Dr. Sadri at www.iranian.org, where he laments the recent phenomenon of U.S. occupation, that's a combination of occupation and liberation, and continues to follow Iran's moves toward reform.
That piece was contributed by Farah Charmchi from Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston. Thanks also to Renee Feltz for production assistance with that report. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.